Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to this program David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois. And once a month on a Friday, he is here and we talk about investing and money management. And the way we do this is that to start, he always has some comments to make. Sometimes he talks a little bit about the economy. Sometimes he talks about some particular topic that he thinks you could use some information on. And then after that, if you have questions about that, whatever it is that he's talked about here to start out with, or anything else that has to do with financial planning, investing, money management, I know that he will do his best to give you some advice. I mean, obviously, we want you to think very carefully about what you do with your money, do all kinds of research, and this can be part of that. So I know he will do his best to help you out when we get around to that point. Well, having said that, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, for the past several months, the financial buzz, of course, is focused on real estate, and more particularly the concept of real estate bubbles. We've talked a little bit about this in the past. Economists and even Alan Greenspan, our Fed chair, has referred to areas of the U.S. as, well, approaching or threatened by real estate bubbles. There's sort of this froth that people are talking about. Well, last week, Carol and I, my wife, spent a few days in one of the hottest real estate markets in the country, that being San Diego, California, and the surrounding metropolitan area of 3 million people. We were the guests of Professor John and Mrs. Grace Masetich. You know John. He's been on our program. He comes out to the University of Illinois once every year in the winter of all times and teaches at the University of Illinois. He also is a professional money manager. And it provided us a good opportunity, one, to take a look at the real estate market in general, and two, John and I to spend a lot of time thinking about whether or not even our own clients should be buying, selling, staying in their real estate, or perhaps changing their investments in real estate through REITs, real estate investment trusts. Now, housing prices, for example, in San Diego have escalated some 40% on average just in the past 3 years, and in many instances, far more. A home, for example, which would fetch a price of, say, $150,000 to $200,000 in central Illinois could easily be priced in excess of $1 million in San Diego, California. Well-located condominiums could command prices of $500 to $1,000 per square foot, depending upon the neighborhood and the view. Now, is San Diego tremendously overpriced? Are some of these other very, very hot urban areas tremendously overpriced compared to, say, Midwest housing stock? Well, undoubtedly, yes. However, a far tougher question to ponder is simply this. Is that kind of real estate, San Diego, San Francisco, Florida, Boston, some of these very hot urban areas, are they likely to see a substantial drop in housing prices? That's a much tougher question. And is this really a housing bubble likely to burst, or is it just as likely that prices will simply level off and not drop precipitously? Well, clearly low interest rates and exotic mortgages such as interest-only mortgages, those are referred to as IOs, interest-only, have contributed to the rapid escalation of housing prices in many urban areas of the country, San Diego being no exception. In fact, during the past 12 months in San Diego, more than 50% of new homeowners have chosen interest-only mortgages. How about that? No equity, just basically interest-only mortgages so as to stretch into a larger, more expensive home. And the California market is rampant with speculators, much like other areas of the country. In fact, it's estimated that one out of every three buyers in California is a speculator. How about that? Now, in spite of all these foreboding signs, I frankly don't believe that the California markets and certain other very hot markets are likely to suffer a precipitous drop in housing prices. More likely, prices will ease, probably at worst, maybe they'll suffer a 10 to 15% correction. Now, that's my view, and let me give you my reasoning. First of all, at least in California, let's keep in mind that it's the sixth largest economy in the world, all by itself, and is an incredible growth engine for the U.S. The high-tech industries, especially Silicon Valley, which we think of more in the San Francisco Bay, San Jose area, and the San Diego high-tech corridor are just, frankly, just flourishing once again, even after we had this tremendous decline in the high-tech sector in 2000, 2001, 2002, and slightly into 2003. Job growth is expanding everywhere in the country. California is no exception, which, of course, is a very important key to price stability of housing. If you are looking at jumping into an urban area and you think that the housing market is hot and it's overpriced, first check out job growth in the area. That is the major leading factor that sustains these tremendously high and expensive real estate prices. California, of course, intends to become the world leader in the burgeoning industry of stem cell research, as evidenced by its $3 billion, that's $3 billion legislative commitment to support private companies developing these new cell lines. Now, compare and contrast that $3 billion number with the, $10 million Illinois commitment, which was recently announced by our governor. Now, many venture capitalists are investing hundreds of millions of dollars into this industry as they are labeling their investments Genetic Valley. We're going to hear this new term. Not Silicon Valley anymore. Now we're going to hear Genetic Valley. So that seems to be the new buzzword. So keep that one in mind. And California, for example, for better or worse, is the largest source of single-person households, which continues to spur demand for housing. And finally, and I think this is very important, housing prices can no longer be viewed from a state-by-state or regional perspective, but rather the housing prices really must be viewed far more globally. For example, housing prices have jumped dramatically all over the world, especially in the past 3 years. Madrid, just picking that out of the hat, Madrid prices for housing 30 to 40% higher than just 3 years ago. New Zealand, haven't been there recently, but New Zealand home prices have jumped 40% at a minimum in the last 3 years. South Africa has a lot of problems, still up some 25%. London, Paris, well, just frankly out of sight in the stratosphere. So clearly resources globally have been pouring into real estate at a frenetic pace, as I think people all over the world seem to feel more comfortable, at least at the moment, with a tangible piece of real estate rather than the intangible stock certificate of a publicly traded company. So for all those reasons, I think we are a lot more likely to experience a fairly soft landing as opposed to tremendous price declines in real estate, especially if mortgage rates continue to be relatively low by historical standards, as 30-year fixed rates, at least even in the United States, continue to fluctuate between 5.5% and 6%, depending upon terms and conditions. And that really provides an avenue, shall we say, of affordability. All right, that's what I want to say about the housing market. I want to move on to another matter, and let's talk a little bit about the stock market. And despite a very choppy stock market, asset class investors really this year have earned positive returns in the stock market. And for example, including dividends, let's look at some of the asset class returns, at least through yesterday. Now, the large cap sector, the S&P 500 index, including dividends, is up just about 2% for the year. Large value, up around 4% for the year. The mid-caps, really the hot sector of the market, often referred to as the S&P 400. If you take the S&P 500 and you forget about the top 100 big companies, because those are really, really big companies, and you look at the next 400, well, that asset class is up some 7% for the year. The Russell 2000, the small caps, and even a little bit smaller than the small caps, up about 5%. Small cap value, 5.5%. The REITs, the Real Estate Investment Trust, still very, very hot sector in spite of this so-called real estate bubble, up some 10% for the year. The international is not faring quite as well. The total international index, really the big companies of the world, the Europe, Australia, Far Eastern type companies, the big ones, up about 1% for the year, including dividends. But emerging markets, much smaller countries, Brazil, for example, Hong Kong, Taiwan, some of these markets, India, Israel, altogether up about 9% for the year. So therefore, I thought it would be worthwhile to share with you, just as I did last month, I shared sort of a 60-40 portfolio with you, 60% equities, 40% fixed income. I'm going to give you my cookbook once again for a 100% equity portfolio. And then I'm going to simply utilize Vanguard funds. However, you could use other mutual funds, other asset class funds. You don't have to use Vanguard. I've talked about it before. They're just easy to use, easy to access. And then I'm going to give you the results year to date. And then each month going forward, I'm going to report on its performance. So we'll sort of have a running performance of a 100% equity portfolio. And I'll report the good, the bad, and the ugly each month coming forward. So let's talk about the 8 index funds that would comprise this 100% equity portfolio. First, the S&P 500. That's pretty easy. And 10 cents of my dollar would go into the S&P 500. A second fund, which was referred to as U.S. value, that's large value. We take the bigger companies and we buy the ones that are sort of on the cheap, according to certain statistical measures. 15% of my dollar, or 15 cents, would go into U.S. value. Small company funds like the Russell 2000, 10 cents, 10% of my dollar. And then small cap value, buying the smaller companies that are selling on the cheap as an asset class, 15 cents of my dollar, or 15%. So I guess I've used up 50% so far. I like the mid caps as an asset class. That's really the S&P 400, 10 cents of my dollar, 10% going into the mid-caps. And, of course, I'm still a real estate investor. I might get blown out of the saddle in these prices. So I'm still a buyer of a REIT index. Now, keep in mind, when you buy a REIT index, you're not buying single-family dwellings. You're buying warehouses, shopping centers, commercial properties, hotels, apartment buildings, etc. So 10 cents is going to go into real estate unless you are already a major holder of real estate. And then I would take that 10% and allocate that across my other asset classes. Total International Index. Vanguard has a Total International Index, which is really the big international companies, Europe, Australia, and the Far East, sort of like something called an EAFE Index. 20% of my money would go into this index. And finally, the emerging markets. 10%. So I think if I've added that up correctly, I believe 10, 30, 40, I better add it up again, 50 and 50. Yep, that's 100% of my money has gone into these 8 different funds for asset classes. Well, how has it done so far this year, including dividends? About 5%, just under 5%. Pretty darn impressive for a well-diversified portfolio, and I believe that to be a well-diversified portfolio. We're 70% U.S., we're 30% international, so we have a smattering of asset classes, nothing very complicated, simple percentages, and again, it's currently running at about 5%. So I'm going to report on this going forward each month, and we'll see how our couch potato equity portfolio performs. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to talk about real estate, talk about asset classes, talk about other things that are on our listeners' minds.
All right. So with that, all you have to do is give us a call. In fact, we have several people who are ready to go. Our guest, by the way, David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and is with us once a month, always on a Friday. We talk about money management and investing. And if you have questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we will start with Oakwood, line one.
Yes, David, my wife and I are taking the required minimum distributions from our IRAs, and it's income we don't need. Our tax rate last year was 16%. We have a six-figure loan at 6% that we'd like to pay off in 3 to 5 years to minimize the amount of interest paid. What's your opinion of taking distributions from IRAs that are in excess of the required minimum distribution in an effort to minimize interest on a loan.
Well, let me ask you a couple of additional questions. Is your loan, first of all, a fixed-rate loan?
Correct.
All right. And are you itemizing on your tax return?
We are not.
Okay. If you are not itemizing on your tax return, then you are paying a pure 6% on that particular loan. And it's also difficult to earn 6% cleanly inside an IRA. So let's say that we earn 6% in our IRA. We're in a 16% tax bracket. So you would be saving 84% of your 6%, right?
Let me clarify something.
All right.
I don't itemize, but I do complete the 4835 and the Schedule E because it's a farm rental income.
So ah,
the
okay.
interest is a cost.
All right. So it's a cost against the farm.
Correct.
All right. And you're looking at the efficacy, again, of taking some additional money out of your IRA.
Correct.
And applying it against the mortgage.
Correct.
To lower it. How old are you?
I am 70.
Well, I'm a great believer of having very, very low debt, certainly when one is over age 65. So I think that the fact that you could take additional monies out of that IRA and you could then look at your effective tax bracket.
Right.
In other words, by looking at it and seeing what that will do to your effective tax bracket. But for me, if my effective tax bracket was still 20% or less, I would be hammering down on that loan.
Okay.
That would be me. That would be my magic number. So I would look at my effective tax rate. How much more money could I take out of my minimum distribution? And at the end of the day, when all the cards are folded, let's stay in an effective minimum tax rate of 20%.
Yes, and that's exactly what I'm doing. Good. I'm glad I'm on track.
Well, good. Good. I think we two people agree.
Excellent. I also have another question. Our finances are getting more complicated and we're getting older. I'm wondering how effective I am. I just wonder if you can recommend off-air an effective financial planner in Champaign-Urbana area.
Sure, be happy to do that. You could call my office at area code 217-265-4083. Be happy to visit with you about that.
Great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate
okay,
right,
my pleasure.
Very good. Thank you for the call. We will continue and we'll talk next with someone in Chicago. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I got a kind of a humorous situation. I've got 6 shares of Azure. That's a Mickey Mouse stock that is spin off from AT&T. I guess you've heard of them.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Did you hear what I was saying about Azure?
Yes.
Yeah. And I got a letter from them. They offered to buy me out. It's worth $71, but they will knock off $2.50 off the price of each share. Vanguard says they'll sell it for me and charge me $30-$40 to sell the $71 worth of stock that I have. So I elected to do nothing. Is that the right thing to do? The whole thing is comical.
Well, it is sort of Mickey Mouse, I guess. Mm-hmm. But in any event, I mean, if you want to hang on to the shares, mm-hmm. then hang on to them. If you're going to sell them, obviously the least expensive way to sell them is when the company itself says, look, you've got an odd lot, you've got a small number of shares, right. We will accommodate a sale.
I'm a nuisance to them, right?
A little bit, but do you have grandchildren?
No, nothing.
No nephews or nieces?
No.
Nobody young to give the stock to?
Just the Shriners.
All right, just the Shriners. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be okay, too. But I think probably if you're going to gift to the Shriners, you're probably better off going ahead and liquidating it at $2.50 a share. It probably won't be ever get any cheaper than that.
There's no sign of growth on that or anything.
Well, I'm not a stock picker, but if you don't have any real reason to sell it, you could always hang on to it. You could always gift it. But otherwise, you could reinvest the $71 minus the commissions elsewhere.
Okay. Thank you.
All okay. Right. A pleasure right. talking with you.
Next is Bloomington, Indiana. This is line 2. Hello. Is there a caller there, line 2 in Bloomington?
Hello.
Yes.
Conventional wisdom has always assumed that high interest rates are bad for stocks. because interest-bearing instruments can, you know, they compete with stocks for investment money. If you've got money to invest and you can invest it at high interest rates, why take the risk of investing in stocks?
The theory of relative attraction.
Yeah, but now I'm hearing some stock experts say that as the Fed raises interest rates for the rest of the year, and they think the Fed will raise interest rates the rest of the year, then those increased interest rates will actually lift stock prices, they say. And the only sense that I can make from their reasoning is the fact that they think that the economy now is expanding fast enough to grow despite the higher interest rates. They think in other words, apparently they think that as the Fed raises interest rates, it is placing a vote of confidence in the economy that will make investors actually prefer stocks over bonds. Have I got that anywhere near right?
Well, I think you're on the right track. The current target Fed funds rate is 3.25%. And if you believe what most pundits seem to be saying, that the Fed is going to continue at their next meeting in August to raise the Fed funds rate again. And I think their ultimate target, assuming inflation is looking reasonably tame despite the volatility of oil, it looks like their target funds rate is about 4%.
Yes.
If that is indeed true, we're looking at a prime of about 7%. So Wall Street prime, we would look at it 7%. And I think historically, when you see a 7% prime, you still see pretty substantial growth in the stock market. So we're not in that area where we're seeing dramatically high interest rates. So I think that's what we're really talking about, is that the Fed has been very measured. It's been going up 9 times, 0.25% every time. And even if we move to a target fund Fed rate of 4%, still, we're in reasonably measured interest rate times. Now, the other reason that stocks historically have hated high interest rates is not only relative attraction. Say, gee, I think I'll just go buy some bonds and cash in my stocks. It's more expensive for companies to borrow money. So when companies borrow money, either they go to a money center bank and borrow money, they issue their own commercial paper, their own IOUs, if you will, it becomes more expensive. And when you're paying more interest out the door, you're less profitable. You're going to earn less per share. So that's the other reason that stocks, typically it's been thought that stocks hate high interest rates. But I don't think we're moving into an area of dramatically high interest rates historically. We're sort of moving back into an average range of interest rates. So on that basis, if the economy continues to grow, if inflation, as it's currently reported the last couple of months, with the exception of the volatility of oil, we're not seeing a lot of inflation at the retail level. I think that's all very positive for stocks. And it is played out, interestingly enough, in the first 6.5 months of this year with an equity portfolio up 4 or 5%.
Yeah, it has. Thank you very much.
All right, my pleasure.
Thanks for the call. We are already here at our midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. This is our regular monthly program on personal finance. Our guest is David Sinno. He's clinical professor of finance at U of I College of Business and has been with us now on a regular basis for quite a long time.
15 years, David.
15 years to discuss these questions.
And you're not retired yet, David. I don't understand.
I'm never retiring, Dave.
All right.
333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Next, let's talk with someone in Aurora on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, I hope you help me form my question. I have a question, but I don't know how to ask it. I have a small amount of money, $2,000, and I know you should have closer to $10,000 to invest. But I have this money, and I don't know where to put it. And I don't know if I should. I do have stock, but I wanted to invest it in this PPL. It's a utility company in Chicago, and I'm only making 3.25% on that stock. And I wondered. I hear you saying 5%. Isn't that what you said when you started the program? Something about 5%.
Well, I said that in a well-diversified equity portfolio this particular year, that you would be ahead approximately 5% in the particular couch potato portfolio that I articulated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have $2,000 that is money that you're desirous of investing.
Yes.
And you don't need this for emergency funds.
No.
All right. And you don't need this to put in a college education fund for grandchildren.
You know, I tried to do that, and I got lost in how to do it.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you need to go to an advisor to help you do it then.
What?
Maybe you could do it through an advisor. That might be helpful. I'm really loathe to recommend that you take the $2,000 and put it in any individual stock. One, as I've told you, I'm not a stock picker. So the minute I would say that's okay, I would probably be dead wrong. And number two, it would violate my notion of a diversified portfolio. So I really can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But something that is interesting out there, especially in the suburban Chicago area, there are a lot of financial institutions that are just dramatically in need of money, apparently because of loan demand, and they are fighting for money. And for the first time, you are seeing any number of banks offering one-year CD rates in excess of 4%.
Really?
So while you may be thinking that your utility stock is going to pay you 3, and maybe you're going to have some growth, maybe if you really can't decide, park the money for a year and take a look at some of the banks that are offering 4%. You can go to the internet at moneyrates.com, and you can look at all of the different banks all over the country that are paying 4% on one-year CDs, and you'll find a number of them in the Chicago area.
I thought CDs were a thing not to do, and I didn't know why.
Well, I don't know. They're insured. They're always good things to have. They're an asset. They're FDIC insured, and currently 1 year they're paying 4%. So
really?
That would perhaps be a better piece of
bank.
Advice.
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, that's all right. I'm just saying that perhaps that would be my best advice, is to take a look at that.
Okay, thank you. So what about credit unions? They don't pay a good percent?
Well, they do. They do. You could compare them. I just feel more comfortable with my FDIC insurance. That's all.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. Thank you.
Right. Okay, very good. Next, we have some other callers here. Back closer to where we are. Someone, in fact, in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I'm going to have to make my first withdrawal on my 403Bs and on my IRA. I've found a little chart that tells me the percent. I know that I could wait until after the first of the year and do two, but I think it would be better for me to spread that out over it. My question is, I have two 403Bs and one regular IRA. Do I have to figure each account separately, or can I, even though they're at different institutions, could I add the 403Bs together, or could I add the 403Bs and the IRA the IRA. So I don't know exactly. I have the percent, and I know I'm going to do it this year, but probably on the 31st of December. But I don't know how to figure it.
Okay, well, number one, I would not wait until the 31st of December.
Because
sometimes things don't get done on time.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
So I think
you'd be much better advised to do this in early December.
Okay.
Especially if you're dealing with companies, mutual funds, et cetera. So please don't wait until December 31.
Okay.
You are quite right that the general rule says that you must start taking your first minimum distribution the April following the year in which you reach 70.5.
Right.
So I presume that you're reaching 70.5 this year, although you sound pretty young over the telephone.
Well, thank you, but I am.
Right? So that you are. And that most people are best advised to go ahead and take a distribution in the year in which they're 70.5 and then another distribution next year, because if they wait, then maybe that double distribution, if you will, aggregated together, places them in a higher tax bracket.
Right.
So you've already probably done that. Now, theoretically, you can actually take these tax-deferred accounts and say, all right, I add all of those together, And this is my percentage that I'm required to take
right.
on the basis of the total. And you could actually access that from one fund so long as you notify the other companies or the other plan sponsors, if you will, that you have met your minimum distribution of X number of dollars out of this account from another account.
Okay, and that would include my IRA?
Yeah, generally it does. But you have to go back to each company and make sure that they are able to accommodate that for you.
Okay.
Because I have run into cases where they said, well, that's very nice, but we're not going along with that. Take your minimum distribution. All right?
Okay. All
so
right.
make certain that you coordinate this among your plan sponsors. Talk to them specifically about this
okay.
as well. Now, generally, that distribution is based upon the previous December 31 plan balance. That's how you figure it. So whatever your plan balance was the previous December 31, use that percentage to determine what your minimum distribution is. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And many companies will provide that number for you. But I would get on this in the fourth quarter of 2005, so you've got plenty of time to coordinate this.
Okay.
But you're on the right track.
Good. Thanks.
All right. Very good. Let's go to Georgetown for our next caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
David, I've listened to your cookbook here. I listened to it, I believe, last month, too, or 2 weeks ago, whenever you did the last. Anyhow, I wrote it very diligently, wrote it down.
Yeah.
Can you tell me and others why you don't mention the Vanguard total stock market, which is supposed to be the answer to a maiden's prayers?
Okay. That's a great question. Because if we look at the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index, which does represent all of these companies, it's sort of like a Wilshire 5000. It's supposed to represent a statistical relationship of all of these companies that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange and the American and the NASDAQ and you name it. The problem is that the Vanguard Total Market Index is dominated by the S&P 500. And further dominated by the S&P 100. So about 85% of your money, as I recall, is really S&P 500.
How much of it?
85%. So when you invest your dollar or 50 cents or whatever, a penny in the total market index, 85% of that investment is really just the S&P 500. So you're not getting the bang for your buck. You're not getting the diversification. You're not getting the percentage allocation that you need in the small caps and the small cap value. And I know you're a sophisticated investor, so I know that you're not just going to buy the total stock market index.
Well, it just seemed odd. Like I said, it's just supposed to be the greatest thing to slice bread. And,
right.
And your conversation was devoid of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, Scott Burns, mm-hmm. who is an excellent financial mm-hmm. columnist, is moving away from the total market index as part of the couch potato. He's looking, for example, if you want to be in just large companies, he's looking far more diligently at large value, and he's written a number of articles about saying substituting large value and large for the total market index.
Mm. Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Very good. Let's see where we will go next. We will talk next with someone here in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about, stocks doing about 5% per year recently.
Well, I was talking about my model portfolio. Mm-hmm. I wasn't talking about individual stocks.
Yeah, right. Can I ask you, what's your time frame for that?
Well, I'm talking about the time frame since January 1 through yesterday.
January 1st of 2005?
Yes, through this year. That's what this portfolio has done.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a pretty short time frame. Then you're not talking about like the last several years or anything like that.
Well, over the last several years, if I went back and if you did the analysis of this, I think what you would find is that this portfolio is probably between 8 and 10%.
8 to 10%.
Sure.
All right.
Does that help you?
Well, actually, there are two points. First of all, The money supply growth has been running about it's been running about 5 to 10%, maybe more like 5% recently. Annual money supply growth has been running around 5%, maybe a little more, and so it's kind of just keeping up with the money supply more so than anything else.
Well, actually, when I track a portfolio, I want it to basically outperform inflation. That's what I'm looking for. I think the best way to analyze a portfolio is, how did my portfolio do versus inflation? In other words, am I ahead of my purchasing power risk? And that's what I'm really looking for. And if I can outperform my purchasing power risk by 2 to 4, maybe 5%, I'm a pretty happy camper. So whether it's 8%, 10%, 14%, or 2%, it's an issue of what inflation is doing. That's the real issue for me.
Right, but of course there's two problems with that. First of all, it depends on, well, first of all, there's a lot of problems with measures of inflation.
No question. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just simply saying that if we could get a reasonable measure of inflation, that's what I want to look at in terms of how my portfolio performs. So I'm not discounting the money supply or any of these other things. I'm simply saying that that's how I look at it.
Yeah. And the other thing is that if you go back like a couple of years to that big reflation trade, everything has been going up. I mean, you look at, you know, healthcare costs, higher education costs, of course, real estate, commodities, just about everything has been going up. Just so saying, okay, well, 5 or 10%, almost everything's been going up 5 or 10% against the U.S. dollar for about, you know, 3, 4, 5 years now.
And you've made my point. I want to look at my rate of return vis-a-vis inflation and what everything else is doing and how it impacts my purchasing power.
Right. But the point is that if those other things are the things you want to buy, then stocks are basically just running in place relative to those other things.
Well, I think historically what you will find if you go back and you actually take a long-term view, and what I caution all of my listeners are that I want them to be what I refer to as legacy investors. If you're not going to stick around the stock market for a heck of a long time, then you don't need to be in the stock market. But if you compare stocks, a well-diversified portfolio over long, long periods of time to inflation or to any other asset class, the bottom line is that they've outperformed. They've outperformed all of these other anterior investments, and it's outperformed inflation. It stayed ahead of purchasing power risk. So again, you and I sort of agree here, but we have to take a long-term view. And all I was pointing out in my couch potato portfolio, carrying it forward now from show to show, which I've never done in the past, I said, well, let's get a starting date at least January 1 of 2005.
Okay, well, mm-hmm. I'll close with two things. First of all, I think that the whole legacy thing is very foolish. A person saving up for their retirement or for their children's college fund cannot afford to wait 20 or 30 years to take profits. And second of all, if you look at other asset classes such as precious metals, precious metals are up at least 10%, and that's over the last 4 or 5 years. And that's from, if you look at things like market capitalization, from much lower valuations, and I would say they have much more potential for continuing to go up instead of just trading in a range. Anyway, thanks.
All right. Okay, and I just wanted to make one last comment about precious metals. While precious metals do go up, they are an extremely volatile asset class. Witness all of the folks who jumped into gold at $700-$800 and rode it all the way down to $200. So as an asset class, it may have a place in an overall portfolio, but just to go out and jump into it, I'd be very, very cautious. And that's what's great about this program, is that intelligent people can disagree. And I would repeat that I think I'm simply not smart enough to jump in and out of the stock market or jump in and out of asset classes. So I feel a lot more comfortable. It's a lot easier for me to sleep at night knowing that history sort of is on my side by being a long-term investor. But our last caller made some excellent points.
Okay. Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Senno. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business and has been with us now once a month for a while to talk about personal finance, money management, always on a Friday. And as I said at the beginning of the program, obviously we think this is a good source of information for you, give you something to think about. Dave will help you out if you want to call and ask a question. And of course, we want you to think very carefully and do your homework and do all the research that you possibly can before you decide to do, you know, whatever you're going to do with your money. Don't just do it because Dave says so, okay?
Heck, my wife doesn't do it because I say so.
I'll not comment. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here we have somebody on a cell phone. It's line number one. Hello.
Good morning, guys.
Yes.
I'm 52, and I will be retiring at age 55, and with a relatively decent pension. I have some IRA money and some 457 money and things like that put away. But the question is relates to $100,000 that I put away 2 years ago. It was the result of a home sale and an estate settlement. And I put it into a manager managing it, but I put it into an asset protection group of investments, meaning there's a lot of cash, there's a lot of CDs, and that's cash, a lot of bonds and things like that. So it really wasn't designed to grow. The question would be, how aggressive should I be with that chunk of money? Can I afford to be a little more aggressive and step out of the asset protection mode and do something more, a little more risky?
Well, let me ask you some basic questions. You're 52 years of age now, and you plan to retire at age 55 with a pension.
Yes.
Is your pension indexed for inflation?
Yes.
That's very, very positive. Because the moment I hear that your pension is indexed for inflation, that provides you some additional flexibility with this other money. Are you going to have to access any IRA or 457 money under the age 55 early distribution rules?
No.
Okay, great. If that pension, which is indexed, is going to sort of take care of things along with other ancillary investments, 52, 53 is pretty darn young. Actuarially, your life expectancy is at least into the mid-80s. It's interesting. The older we get, the older we are likely to live. And the average male who is in good health at age 52 is likely to live well into his 80s. So we're looking at a time horizon of 25, 30, 35 years at a minimum. And if you don't have an immediate need for that money, or if you see this as long-term investable funds, then by all means you could take a bit more risk, but I'm not sure that it's really more risky, because if you are simply in this asset protection program, you may not even be keeping up with inflation at the current time. So
I'm doing that. It's a pretty good program.
Okay. So to have an allocation of, say, even 40% in equities and 60% in fixed income would certainly not be unreasonable at your age. Certainly wouldn't be unreasonable. So if you are 100% in fixed income and you feel that you can take a bit more risk, then by all means, you certainly could dollar cost average or have your manager dollar cost average you into a situation where you could be a bit more exposed to equities. I wouldn't have any problem with that at all, especially when you tell me you've got an indexed pension.
Right. Would you go into the all equities fund like your couch potato group?
Well, that's me. Okay. And I'm not saying that's the end all be all. There are other people who have other programs. I like something simple and something that works, and that works for me. So that's just one example. I'm more concerned that you have a broad, diversified equity exposure with a percentage of this money. That's what I'm more concerned about.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank you, David.
Very good.
My pleasure.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to next caller. This is someone here in town locally, Champaign-Urbana, line two. Hello.
Can I comment on Sarbanes and other reforms? Like now corporations cannot loan their officers big amounts of money, and some CEO just got 25 years in the big house.
Yeah, Mr. Ebbers.
Bernie Ebbers, yeah.
Art imitates life. Dreiser wrote a novel where a defense attorney in the same situation argued his client was no good at basket weaving and should be encouraged to continue financial speculation, better to pay back the teachers who were going to go bankrupt otherwise. Thanks.
Okay, you know, the caller mentioned a lot of interesting things, including Sarbanes-Oxley, and we could spend shows on Sarbanes-Oxley. And David, maybe that's a topic for a program on Sarbanes, because it's having an enormous impact on corporate America, far beyond the issues of fraud, far beyond the issues of can we loan money to senior executive officers, but more from an accounting standpoint and more from a systems standpoint, that companies are going through rigorous amounts of compliance issues so that their financial statements are believable and are credible, so you and I, as stock market investors, can believe what these companies are telling us. So it's a fascinating area. It's a huge growth area for companies.
Well, maybe we see if we do some programs on that on some other days. Let's go next. We'll talk with someone in Peoria. This is on our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yes. I'm wondering how one can find someone who – where you can get invested in Vanguard. Like if I look in the phone book under Vanguard, there's nothing there, but –
No, the easiest thing to do is to go to their website, www.vanguard.com. And then when you go to their master sheet, it will come up. You can go to the area and click on personal investors. We have institutional investors and personal investors. That will be the first thing that will show up on the Vanguard website. And you click on there. It's a very user-friendly website, and they can take you all through the website. And in fact, Vanguard also has many educational pages of information. So before you even start thinking about investing, you can read a lot of philosophy, a lot of information with reference to how they invest your money and how they think about investing your money. It's a great website.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, thanks. Can you also go, you know, for example, to wherever you bank? Can you go through them?
Well, not generally for Vanguard, because Vanguard is a direct provider. In other words, we don't have an individual who is a commissioned broker, a commissioned banker, et cetera, who is going to earn anything from placing you in investments at Vanguard. Mm-hmm. So Vanguard is really a direct provider of financial mutual funds and services.
So you just go right to them and deal with them.
In fact, you can download the forms online, et cetera, send your money in, but you have to understand and do a lot of research and know what you are doing. Never, ever get involved in an investment you do not understand. Rule number 1, just don't do it. Sit on the sidelines. Don't let money burn a hole in your pocket. Park it at the bank, for goodness sake, before you do anything like that.
All right. Vermilion County, this is the next caller. Line number 3. Hello.
Good morning. I got some bills, like mail from my investment company. Talking about retirement funds that are aimed at different age groups. So I think they're about spread about 5 years apart. If you're going to retire in 25 years, 10 years, 15, something like that. What do you think of those? Can you comment on those?
Well, they're very interesting. They're relatively a new player on the block. They're called target retirement funds. And basically, if you have a target retirement date, for example, of 2025, let's say 20 years in the future, then today that retirement fund might be 70% stocks, 30% fixed income. But as you approach your target retirement date, that allocation automatically changes for you, where presumably there would be less risk by having more money in fixed income, especially shorter-term fixed income, which is not nearly as volatile, and less money in stocks. So the verdict's sort of out on those items yet because they're relatively new. I think in theory they make some sense, but you can do this yourself by utilizing your own mutual fund. So they're really doing it for you in a sense, and giving you a particular target date. And then that portfolio changes its risk posture as you get closer to that retirement date.
Would that save you the trouble of having to rebalance every year?
Well, I think it would. I think it would. But again, it depends on which funds you're using, which providers you're using. And I think you would have to talk to them specifically about how they rebalance. You must be sophisticated because you're bringing up an issue, and that is that a portfolio should be rebalanced once a year because maybe one asset class just gets out of kilter. It moves through the stratosphere, and now it's too tilted on that particular asset class, so we have to rebalance. But again, by all means, I think you're on the right track. But you need to do a lot of talking with the advisor or the fund or the people and how they specifically manage that target retirement account. Vanguard is, it's very reputable. And as I say, these are relatively new funds, and it explains in the prospectus precisely how those funds are managed. So I don't have any particular negative feeling about utilizing those particular target retirement funds. I think if you want to do less work and less research and rely on a company, then that makes some sense. But I feel more comfortable when I have a hands-on and I'm looking at my own portfolio with a number of asset classes. That's just me, however.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Obviously, the advantage of dealing with a large company like Vanguard, and it is just one, there are others.
Absolutely.
Is that they have all of these different funds. It's sort of under one umbrella. You can allocate it. You can basically write one check. It goes to Vanguard, and you tell them, okay, here's where I want you to put the money. And then periodically, I'm sure there's a limit to how many times they can do it, but periodically you could say to them, all right, I want to change it. This is what it was before. This is what I want
you to
be now.
No question. And, you know, those funds, interestingly enough, have attracted a lot of young money, people who are very, very young, opened up an IRA, say, look, I'm retiring in 40 years. Put me in the Vanguard long-term retirement target, whether it's 2045, 2050, et cetera. So while you think it might be people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, interestingly enough, it has attracted a substantial amount of money from very, very young people who say, I don't want to be bothered. Do it for me.
One quick, we'll try to do one quick call, Champagne. Line one. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Last month, you gave another list of besides the one that you were just now giving at Vanguard, not the couch potato, but another one, which said if you want to be a little more active,
Yes, I gave another portfolio last month where basically 50% of my money was in stocks and about 50% was in fixed income. So I guess I would either be half right or half wrong,
uh-huh.
But a fairly conservative portfolio. And basically on the equity side, it used very, very similar funds. It was just basically using only 50% of the money. And then on the fixed income side, I was using very short-term corporate bond indexes at Vanguard called the Total. Actually, there's a total bond index which could be utilized with portion of your money and then also the short-term bond index. So I had a combination of those two indexes with the other 50% of my money.
And I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to jump in here on the call because we're just out of time for this time around. Maybe next month when Dave comes back, we can review that one again. We can review this one just to make sure that people have the information and, of course, take whatever questions they have.
Thanks David, it's been fun.
Dave Sinnoh, he is a clinical professor of finance at the U of I. He's with us once a month to take questions on money management.